and complete car maintenance, scheduled maintenance, and repair service, including a nationwide warranty by ASE-certified technicians. Located near the U of I campus with shuttle service available. More information is available at 367-0300.
This is Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Martha Deal, Harriet Williamson, Henry Frain at the controls. This is hour number two of our program. And in this hour, we'll be talking about Afghanistan. And our guest is a journalist who's been reporting on Afghanistan and Pakistan for now something like 18 years. Her name is Kathy Gannon. She was the Associated Press correspondent in Pakistan, Afghanistan from 1986 until 2005, and right now she is the Iran Bureau Chief Designate for AP. She was born in Canada, has won a number of honors for her work, including the 2002 International Women's Media Foundation Courage in Journalism Award. She also was the recipient of an Edward R. Murrow Fellowship from the Council on Foreign Relations for 2003-2004. Her writing has been published in a number of places, including Foreign Affairs and The New Yorker, as well as the Canadian news magazine Maclean's and the Christian Science Monitor. She has authored a book based upon her experiences in Afghanistan, going back to the Russian invasion, or the period after that when the Russians left. The book is titled I Is for Infidel, the subtitle From Holy War to Holy Terror, 18 Years Inside Afghanistan. Public Affairs is the publisher of the book. She is now spending some time in the United States talking about the book and about Afghanistan, and she's joining us by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program going, get in as many callers as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to join in the conversation. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Ms. Gannon, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. If you wouldn't mind a personal question at the beginning, I'm just curious about why it is that you decided that you wanted to be a foreign correspondent.
Oh, you know, David, it's something that I always wanted to do. You know, I come from a very small place in northern Canada, and when I got into newspapers, one of the things I really wanted to do was travel. So it's really been something that I wanted to do. I worked across Canada at newspapers. I was a city editor at one, and wanted to get to see Canada itself first, and then I wanted to travel abroad.
And how is it that you ended up going to Afghanistan?
Well, you know, I was traveling with a photographer friend of mine who had taken some very powerful and beautiful pictures of Afghan refugees in the early 1980s in northwest Pakistan. And also, I was very much interested in Israel and Palestine and that area as well. So we did do some traveling there, but freelancing in Israel was very difficult because, as you can imagine, most newspapers had their own people. And then we went to Pakistan and the border area in Afghanistan, where it really was a wonderful story in terms of, you know, that whole David and Goliath battle, the Soviet army invading Afghanistan, these Mujahideen fighters, guerrilla fighters, and it turned out then to be the last big Cold War proxy battle, really. And so there was some interest, but you really had to work to sell your material when we first got there.
Mm-hmm. There is so much we could talk about. I don't know how far back we really need to go in Afghanistan's history, but I was thinking perhaps at least going back to the point where the Russians, the Soviets, left. They, mm-hmm. as people will recall, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan at the end of 1979, and they were there for 10 years. It was a period that was very, very destructive, laid waste to a lot of the country. A lot of people died, and finally the Soviets left after having fought off the guerrillas, the Mujahideen, for all of those years. And it seemed that I'm sure that a lot of people's minds, maybe the one of the great tragedies of recent history in Afghanistan is having driven the Soviets out. the fighters started to fight among each other. And so we went from an insurgency to drive out an invader to a civil war, which was equally destructive. What happened in that intervening period, just right after the Soviets left, and could somehow things have gone differently?
Yeah, you know, I think what happened too, as you so well explained it, one of the things was that the people that were put into power, the Mujahideen, there was a period from 89 to 92 when Najibullah was there, and the communist backed, or the Moscow backed president rather, in Afghanistan. What happened was that the people who were put in power in 92, at the end of when Najib stepped down, they had a history of having fought with each other. They had signed agreements in the past and had broken those agreements. But the international interest was gone in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and actually in Pakistan as well. You know, during the whole 1980s, when Zia-ul-Haq was the military dictator, was in power in Pakistan, each year, the U.S. president signed off that Pakistan didn't have a nuclear weapon, wasn't developing nuclear weapons. And that continued until 1990, after the Soviets pulled out of Afghanistan, when the Cold War battle was over and the collapse of the Berlin Wall was occurring, and the interest in the region had gone. And in 1990, suddenly, the U.S., stopped all military and humanitarian aid to Pakistan and said, oh, Pakistan, because Pakistan has a nuclear weapons program. Yet just the year before, and for the successive years before that, they had signed off saying, no, Pakistan was not developing a nuclear program. There was a knowledge that the people who took power in 1992, the Mujahideen leaders, that they had signed agreements, had broken agreements in the past, but again, the interest wasn't in developing a stable, long-term stability in the region. It was the interest was gone. The world had moved on. The West had moved on, and so it was just to, okay, these were the victors, hand them off the prize, and goodbye. And so that sort of started beginning of the anarchy inside of Afghanistan under the Mujahideen. Certainly when the Soviets were there, and it should be known that the Soviet Union, when they invaded Afghanistan, while Kabul survived pretty much unaffected, there was massive bombing of rural areas, and over a million Afghans were killed during the 1980s when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. So, you know, there's sort of no good guys in this story.
Yeah. And then what happened was when the period that we get into here, we're talking about the Civil War period, then the focus of the fighting was much more urban areas, Kabul
sure.
particularly.
Exactly.
And so then it was it was in a sad way, it was the turn of city folks
sure.
to experience the kind of violence and destruction that had been visited upon people who previously had been living in the rural areas.
Sure, exactly. And really what happened between 1992 and 1996, which really gave rise to the Taliban, was a bitter, bitter battle between different factions, Mujahideen groups in Kabul. And during that time, and this is a Red Cross figure, 50,000 Afghans were killed, and they were killed by some of the very same people who are back in positions of power today in Afghanistan, who committed terrible atrocities. You know, one of the people is Abdulrazul Sayyaf, who is a power broker today in Afghanistan. His ally is the Chief Justice, is a governor of Ghazni. So very, very influential. And I remember going into an area in Kabul after his people had left, and his men had left. It was a Hazara area, which is an ethnic minority in Afghanistan who have been, you know, brutalized by every regime just about. And his people had scalped five women and killed them, obviously. And so, I mean, the atrocities committed then and the repressiveness against women as well during that period was really a phenomenal part of Afghan history. And some of those very same people are back in power today in Afghanistan, which is worrisome for Afghans.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's there's one line that just sort of leapt off the page when I was looking at it early on in the prologue of the book, where you write something to the effect that things so much has changed and so little has changed. And that would be and one of the ways in which, despite all of this turmoil and the changes of government and the fact that now we have a government that at least there's a government in Kabul with a president who's been popularly elected, that so many of the people that are involved in politics and are vying for power are indeed these same people who were responsible for a lot of violence that followed the driving out of the Russians.
Exactly, exactly. And also, too, which I think is hugely interesting, and is some of those same people are also the ones who brought Osama bin Laden to Afghanistan back in 1996. I mean, the CIA wrongly said that it was, in Richard Clark's book, wrongly said that it was the Taliban who brought Osama bin Laden to Afghanistan in 1996 when he left Sudan, when the United States had sanctioned Sudan and had wanted Sudan to expel Osama, and eventually Sudan did. And Osama was looking for somewhere else to go, and he was actually welcomed to Afghanistan by one of Sayyaf's key lieutenants, Haji Qadir, who was a minister in the first government of Hamid Karzai. He since was assassinated, but he was a minister in Hamid Karzai's first government. He actually gave a speech welcoming Osama to Afghanistan at a lunch that was given for him back in 1996. So I think it's very significant that, you know, the intelligence information, because the Taliban were so demonized, it became acceptable to say anything regardless of whether it was true or not and attribute it to the Taliban. In fact, those training camps that Clark said Mullah Omar wanted Osama to come to Afghanistan so he could finance were actually running between 1992 and 1996. And Ayman al-Zawahiri, the person who is most often seen on videos threatening everyone, the number two, Osama's lieutenant, was in Afghanistan throughout the Mujahideen government, was very close to Sayyaf, was given refuge and safe haven in Afghanistan, despite the fact that he was found guilty in absentia of the assassination of Anwar Sadat. So these were the people that, first off, who are back in positions of power in Afghanistan. These are the same people who the U.S. and the coalition farmed out the job post Taliban of hunting down the al-Qaeda, the same people who actually, in fact, brought them to Afghanistan, not the Taliban, which the CIA today claims that it was the Taliban. In fact, that's not true. The Taliban weren't in power then. The Taliban were still, they hadn't even taken Jalalabad by the time Osama came to Afghanistan. That was still in the hands of the Mujahideen government and people who, as I said, are in positions of power today in Afghanistan.
Do you think that this question that often preoccupies us, that is, where is Osama, does it really matter? And would his capture, do you think, be significant?
Well, you know, I think it would be. I think it would be just in, I don't know that he would actually be captured, because it would be very difficult for anybody to want him in jails in their country because of the fear of attacks. But, I mean, I certainly think his capture or whatever would, he's become kind of like a rallying symbol. And so for sure, as one individual, for sure other people would step up to the plate, and for sure it's a much, much more complex issue than a single individual. But yeah, I do think that the capture of Osama would certainly have a psychological effect, and probably a fairly significant one. Would it put an end to everything? Absolutely not. It's a very complex issue, and it's morphed in so many different ways. But in my opinion, sure, I think it would have an effect.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Kathy Gannon. She was the Associated Press correspondent in Pakistan and Afghanistan from 1986 until 2005, and she is currently the Iran Bureau Chief Designate. When are you going to go to Iran?
Well, yeah, good question, David. Actually, I was there for the elections in June. I'm waiting for my residency visa, and that hasn't come through yet from the Iranian authorities. Once I receive that, I'll go. In the meantime, since February, I've been doing a lot of Central Asia, sort of larger look pictures for AP, which has been fabulous for me, into the Ferghana Valley and Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan during the whole uprising that led to the departure of Akayev. So it's been a really sort of fascinating last several months, but I am waiting for my residency visa. And then I was in Iran during the elections in June as well.
We have a caller. We would welcome others. 333-9455 here for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Caller is in Champaign County on line one. Hello.
Good morning. Welcome back. I wanted to go back to some of the first premises, even as outlined by the host. It seems like the role of the U.S. was given short shrift. We have it from Brzezinski himself that the strategy in Afghanistan, now that people argue, subsequent to his retirement, he took credit for sort of entrapping and bringing the Russians in, provoking the invasion, et cetera, that aid was going into the what is now called the Northern Alliance, some of those factions, Hekmat Diyar, and et cetera, quite a bit before the actual invasion. And it just seems to me that, you know, that the U.S. role just can't be gone over so lightly with that kind of testimony. I think we should do some naming of names and talk about some of the people that are in the mix in the government. I mean, I think the mayor of Kabul actually had to bring Dostum in some way. I've kind of lost track of the factional playing off against each other. But there's the broader point, and then there's some of that detail.
Sure. Well, we certainly don't want to ignore the role of the United States. I'll just give Ms. Gannon give you the opportunity to talk about that.
Sure. Well, for sure, the role of the U.S. in terms during the Soviet invasion. I mean, the U.S. Funded the Mujahideen, the Stinger missiles that was given late 1986 turned around the war. Yes, there was a lot of support. The support went through Pakistan. The support was given to the hardest liners among the Mujahideen groups, to the Sayafs, to Massoud, to Gulbuddin Hekmatyar was one of the biggest recipients, to Mawlvi Khalis, who was very close to Osama and remained so even after September 11th, and his people. The governor of Kabul today, Dean Mohammed, was among those who welcomed Osama back in 1996. So the U.S. Supported Zia-ul-Haq in Pakistan, despite the fact that during that time is when Zia-ul-Haq brought the religious schools in to a great force, the madrasas, to be a great force in Pakistan and involved in Pakistan's education system. Zia-ul-Haq introduced regressive legislation that today haunts Pakistanis, and the U.S. He was the U.S. ally right through as Pakistan was developing nuclear weapons. Today, the military in Pakistan is again a huge ally of the United States, despite the fact that it has literally decimated a civil society, despite the fact that the military in Pakistan has given rise to the religious right, has given the religious right more power than they've ever had before, political power in Pakistan, because Pakistanis, whenever they have voted, and the religious parties have always participated in elections, the Pakistanis have never given more than 9% of the vote to the religious parties. In elections in 2002, under the military government, the religious right today in Pakistan controls two provinces and is the official opposition. So I'm not sure that I'm answering the caller's question or speaking to the issues that he wanted me to.
Well, yeah, partially. And it's interesting you bring up the madrasas because some of the most, not just in the Pashtun, refugee population across the border into Pakistan, but even in the Pakistani madrasas, the U.S. was funding the most incredible jihadist documents as part of their whole outreach. And
sure. Well, even the title of the book, you know, David, the title of my book actually comes from education material that was given to Afghan refugees during the 1980s, during the Soviet invasion, prepared by in the United States and distributed by a U.S. university program to teach the Afghan refugee children English. At that time, it has to be understood, it was the height of the Cold War. It was the whole religious fervor was being encouraged and to fight the godless communists. And the title actually comes from a English language teaching tools that were prepared by the United States for Afghan refugee children, and it was the alphabet, and it was J is for jihad, and K is for Kalashnikov, and I is for infidel, in a reference to the godless communists. And they would have math questions like, if you have 30 communists and you kill 20 communists, how many communists would you have left? So that was the material at the time, because it was the height of the Cold War, because the enemy was the communists, and it was communism was the demon of the time, and that was the material that was prepared and pushed in the schools in the refugee camps among Afghans, prepared by the United States.
That's quite interesting. I wanted to know, the broader thing is that it makes it even more tragic the way the U.S. just walked away. It was clear that it was just basically to bleed the Soviets at the time that the whole thing was done. But there's a guy that's been sort of lionized as the American cowboy that sort of rode with the Mujahideen. I think his name was Wheeler. I don't know if you want to go back and have any anecdotes about him. But also, I don't know if you can update us on, like I say, the current dynamics in the warlordocracy that we've got over there. Thank you.
Charlie Wilson is the only, maybe I'm confusing the two, but Charlie Wilson was very active, and there's a book by George Crowder, Charlie Wilson's War, that looks at, the funding for the Mujahideen. Charlie Wilson certainly didn't ride with the Mujahideen or anything, but was very active in getting funding, U.S. funding for the Mujahideen. Some of the warlords who, it's almost become a misnomer now to call them warlords, because in fact, in today's Afghanistan, they are governors of provinces, they are ministers in the government, deputy ministers in the government. So they are participants in the government. And the argument has been that, better to keep them in the government, and so you bring them into the political process. But the problem with that is, and so create stability in Afghanistan. The problem with that is that 4 years on in Afghanistan, these people, these same individuals who have, that's been the logic of embracing them and bringing them into the government, they have in fact caused the country to be incredibly insecure, have caused the country to be a leading opium producing nation. It is the biggest opium-producing nation in the world, more than every other opium-producing country combined. Afghanistan produces more. It's dangerous. It's a dangerous country outside of the cities. Even in the cities, the rule of law is not enforced, is not followed. So it's actually backfired by embracing these individuals or warlords, and has actually created more instability in the country.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, our guest is Kathy Gannon. She has been a reporter for the Associated Press in Afghanistan, Pakistan for 18 years, going back to 1986, and will sometime soon, I'm sure she hopes, will be taking over her post as the bureau chief for AP in Iran. She was born in Canada and is author of this book that we have. She has mentioned, just talked about the title a little bit, and we have mentioned the book. It's titled I is for Infidel, the subtitle From Holy War to Holy Terror, 18 Years Inside Afghanistan. It's published by Public Affairs, and she's now spending some time in the United States talking about the book and about the politics of the region, and questions are welcome. Thinking back to what was going on in Afghanistan during this period of civil war, where the guerrilla fighters who had succeeded in driving out the Russians were fighting among themselves, and thinking about the rise of the Taliban, thinking back to at least initially, it seems, and you can tell me whether this is really true, that there was actually some popular support, or maybe it was just a feeling of relief when the Taliban came along, that people were so tired of the fighting, they were hoping that someone could rein in all these various violent factions and get them some peace. And that was perhaps before they knew what kind of ideas the Taliban had about government and about how the society should be run. And they became what, you know, became to embody what we now think of as being the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
Is it really, you know, to what extent was this initially a movement that maybe had some broad popular support?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, really at the beginning, it began on a very small scale, and from people who were actually involved in the beginnings of the Taliban, not, you know, from outside and people in hindsight saying, no, this is what happened and this is what happened. From people who were actually involved in the very formation of it, it really did begin as a reaction to the lawlessness, as a reaction to the criminal gangs who would stop you at every 10-kilometer point and take money from you in the form of tolls or taxes. We had our sat phone stolen from us 3 different times. So it really was in response to that lawlessness. Even Hamid Karzai, and I've known Hamid for 16 years at the beginning, and Hamid said, you know, I mean, it was a response to try to get rid of some of these warlords, these commanders who had were so heavily armed, and who, after the pro-Moscow government fell and the Mujahideen were in control, just literally divided the country up among themselves and said, okay, now we can do whatever we want. And a lot of the people who began the Taliban were just village mullahs. And they had been Mujahideen as well. They had fought during the 1980s. But when the Mujahideen government came to power, they basically went back to their homes. And, you know, some of them were mullahs and teaching in these backwater places, you know, in very small little religious schools. Mullah Omar's was I've been to his village. I mean, his school was a mud building. One big room. It wasn't an elaborate institution by any stretch of the imagination. So initially the response was to the lawlessness, and initially it was welcomed as an alternative. And I remember in Kabul at the time, you know, David, and being in the basement of the AP house, and we've had a house there throughout, and counting in a 2-minute period 100 incoming and outgoing rockets, incoming from Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's positions outside of Kabul, outgoing from Ahmad Shah Massoud and SIOP's positions and Dostum's outside and inside, back and forth. And in the middle were the people who were caught. So the idea of the Taliban initially was that it meant an end to the killing. And, you know, people were afraid if they went home, would their family still be alive? You know, somebody stepped out to buy a package of cigarettes, they were killed. You know, I remember going to a house and a little 5-year-old had just stepped out off the front step to play, and a rocket landed, killed her. I mean, you know, it was that kind of frightening fighting that was going on and in the middle where the people. So when the Taliban first took over, for sure people said, you know, at least it means an end to the fighting. And I used to ask women, you know, well, what about the whole burqa thing and everything? You know, they said, at least if we're going to be alive. For sure, initially, they thought, oh, you know, thank God the fighting, it's over. afterwards, after as the Taliban, you know, enforced a very repressive village rule, and really that's what they did, is they took what was and is and remains today sort of village tradition, village culture, and imposed it over the entire country. For sure, people were fed up with that. Once the rocketing stopped, there was a semblance of peace. Then you had time to collect yourself, and my goodness, they for sure hated the repressiveness of the Taliban, as did the men, and frankly, as did the ethnic Pashtuns, who were the backbone of the Taliban. When the Taliban left, were defeated in 2001 by the U.S. and the bombing, the British bombing of the front lines. That's really what defeated the Taliban. People were more than happy to see the back of them, including the ethnic Pashtuns, who weren't concerned about women's issues, but of course were concerned more about being told what to do, how long to grow your beard, no, you can't listen to music, no, you have to wear a turban all the time. That type of imposition of rules and regulations didn't sit well with them. But, you know, there were so many opportunities that were squandered post-Taliban. The ethnic Pashtuns, which were the majority ethnic group, were completely marginalized and punished, as it were, for being part of the Taliban, which in fact, then alienated them. And while the Taliban really was a defeated entity post-September 11th, post-November 13th, actually, or December 7th, when they finally left Kandahar, there was new life breathed into them. And you know, part of that alienation of the ethnic Pashtuns and punishing them, as it were, was also part of, was pushed by the U.S. and its policymaker at the time, who was there, the special envoy to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, who allowed the Northern Alliance or ethnic minorities, to have the power and sideline the ethnic Pashtuns, which further created divisions in an already divided country, but further created divisions and really, you know, honestly, David, breathed life back into the Taliban, because ethnic Pashtuns who really wanted to give the whole administration a change, a chance, in the end, 2 years later, said, fine, you know, I'm your enemy, okay? You think I'm your enemy? I am your enemy. And really is causing problems today in Afghanistan.
Well, how many people, former Taliban, are now involved in government today?
Well, it's not even so much a question of former Taliban who are involved in government today. There aren't that many. There's certainly, you know, former Taliban who have been involved in this election. But the Taliban, and I mean, just as you have some of the former Mujahideen, you know, the Sayyids and that, who on an equal basis have a lot to answer for. Some of the former Taliban, and there was an element within the Taliban, and I was there throughout the Taliban, so, you know, people who I knew who talked to me when the Taliban were very strong, they didn't have to say things to against the Taliban, because of course it made no difference to them, because the Taliban was very strong, so they weren't saying it to save their skins or anything like that, which people say, you know, okay, well, once the Taliban were defeated, of course, then suddenly these so-called moderates appeared. But in fact, I met people who I quote in my book during the peak of the Taliban, when they were unchallenged, when they were strong, who, for example, during the whole issue of the Buddhas, the destruction of the Buddhas. There was one who I quote, and this was before September 11th, during the discussions about the destruction of the Buddhas, said to the Shura, to the Taliban, he was a deputy interior minister, he said, it would be better that you cut the throat of my son than you destroy these Buddhas, because they are our heritage. So that's also part of what that was also, those were people who were also involved as well. And that's what happens when you make everything black and white and you demonize, you lose sight of any other elements within. And so the Taliban wasn't just Mullah Omar and wasn't just the Obaidullah defense minister or whoever. It was, you know, just as the Mujahideen weren't just the PSYOPs or the who are back today.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems that whenever we look at another country where our relationship is problematic and there's a government there mm-hmm. in place that's difficult, and it seems that we always tell ourselves the story that says, well, there must be somebody there that we can work with. And if we just could identify people who were of a more moderate frame of mind and found some way to talk with them, then we could, and perhaps it's a mistaken thinking, but that we could somehow steer this government and its policy in a direction that we would find more favorable. Is it actually possible that at some point we could have established a more positive kind of relationship with the Taliban?
Sure.
And indeed done that and perhaps nudged them in a direction that would be more progressive than it was, and we would have ended up with a government that, in fact, we could have worked with?
Sure. I mean, whether the outcome might have been, it would just be pure speculation. But mm-hmm. for sure, there were elements, and in fact, there wasn't an attempt to try and find those elements and to try and negotiate with them, to try and find a middle ground. There wasn't even an attempt. I mean, you know, President Rabbani, who led the Mujahideen government between 92 and 96, when 50,000 Afghans were killed, kept the seat at the UN during the Taliban time because... I'm not sure why, but as opposed to leaving the seat empty, even if the international community said, hey, listen, we're not giving it to the Taliban, but leave the seat empty. But no, it stayed with President Rabbani despite the deaths that occurred during his time in power. When in January 2002, I was in Kandahar, and I was talking to some U.S. Marines, and one senior Marine, once he realized I'd been around for a while, we were just chatting, it was all on background, we were just talking, and he said, you know, he says, for 5 years we're completely disengaged from here. We, you know, have no intelligence. We don't know who's who. We get a call from somebody who is supposedly our ally now. We don't know the details of this person, but, you know, he's now our ally. We get a call that there's some convoy moving through a mountain pass, and there's Al-Qaeda in the convoy. Now, he says, we don't know because we don't have any good intelligence in this country because the U.S. wasn't involved. They make a few phone calls. They call the U.S. Embassy. They really try. I mean, from the soldier's perspective, they really do try to find out. And then they have to make a decision. Do they call in the air power? Maybe it is some big Al-Qaeda person. You know, are they going to let an Al-Qaeda person get away? You know, it was a real disservice to the military, the taking this approach and not developing good intelligence, not being involved. And so they make a decision, and hopefully it's right, and sometimes it's wrong. But that's the position that the U.S. puts its own people in by having chosen to demonize the Taliban. I don't know, could September 11th have been avoided? Who knows? Could Mullah Omar have been convinced to hand over Osama bin Laden? Who knows? You know, I think, but certainly the more moderate, and certainly not, you know, liberal by our standards, but, you know, the more moderate within the Taliban, they had no backing from the international community, and the hardliners just got stronger and stronger and stronger. And it was impossible for the more moderate-minded to rally people because people thought, you know, the world doesn't care what happens to us. I mean, they'll just say Taliban. If a whole bunch of Taliban get killed, they'll say, well, it's just Taliban got killed. There's no distinction. So it was impossible for the more moderate-minded, by their standards, who still would support education, but it would be would not be co-ed and would support, you know, women working. But it would be, you know, with hijab, face open maybe, but still heads covered. But still, you know, within their environment and their culture, much more moderate. But they had no ability to rally people because people said, you know, I mean, so we rise up and we get killed. You know, I mean, nobody's going to say anything or care. And so they had no support. So it did work against, I think. the West.
We have about 15 minutes left. Kathy Gannon is our guest. She was Associated Press correspondent in Pakistan and Afghanistan from 1986 until 2005 and is going to be soon taking over as the bureau chief for AP in Iran. She's the author of the book, I Is for Infidel, From Holy War to Holy Terror, 18 Years Inside Afghanistan, published by Public Affairs. We have some callers here. We'll try to get everybody in. Folks can help us by also trying to be brief. We'll go to Urbana for the next, line one. Hello. Yes.
You've already covered part of what I wanted to bring up, that the Taliban really wasn't a solidified, unitary group, that there were perhaps not liberal elements, but conservative and then ultra-radicals. Mm-hmm. That's never been acknowledged by the administration, has it?
No, it hasn't. Because the Taliban really were just sort of lumped together and said, okay, they were totally just demonized, and they were, you know, and so it was not possible from the very beginning. I mean, there was no effort, actually. Not that it wasn't possible. There was no effort from the very beginning to try, when the Taliban took power, after they hanged Najibullah, really, the communist president, the pro-Moscow president who had been living under UN protection in Kabul from 92 to 96, the Taliban, as soon as they took power in September 1996, the first thing that was done, and it was done by a relative of Mullah Omar, but, you know, it was done by a person who wanted revenge because had lost some family members during the 1980s, and Najib was seen as this evil person who had been aligned with the communists and had wreaked this havoc, and they hanged him, and after that it tortured him and hanged him. I mean, it was brutal. There's no question. After that, the Taliban were largely written off, and the UN completely sidelined them because the person who had given Najibullah that promise of sanctuary, Benon Savant, was in charge of security at the time, and he took effectively his revenge for Najib's killing by declaring Afghanistan one of the most insecure places under the Taliban, which of course was wrong. But you know, and so the UN withdrew a lot, and it just was from there. It was just they were automatically made a pariah, and suddenly the women's issue became very significant. When the UN, I might add, completely ignored the fact that the Taliban ordered women off the jobs in each of the places they took control of, and the UN itself listened to the Taliban in Kandahar when they took Kandahar and Herat, and sent their female employees home despite the fact that it violated the UN charter, and they never once, before the Taliban took full control, complained to the Taliban about that. Not once.
Do you place any credence in the claim that the Taliban own divisions were reaching the point where they probably would have been torn apart and something would have replaced them?
You know, by the time September 11th happened, you know, and because of the whole Buddha situation in March, or I think it was March of 2001, you know, I think at that point, like in March in that area, Osama and Al-Qaeda had really strong control already of the defense ministries and the intelligence ministries, and the Northern Alliance had been really reduced to a very small portion of the country, and a lot of the more difficult front lines were in the hands of the Arabs more than anything. And so by 2001, you know, from what I could tell from different people within the Taliban that I knew, this is before September 11th, that there was already a tremendous control of the organization of the movement and the shura, which is the council that made the decisions for the Taliban. The powerful ministries were really largely controlled by Al-Qaeda, and certainly had the connivance too of the Pakistani intelligence and military. So I don't know what at that point, because you know, in 2001, I don't know what would have happened had 2001 not September 11th not occurred, and I think the Al-Qaeda, Osama, the planning was already very much, you know, in place, and it was very calculated in terms of the isolation and the control that they solidified over the Taliban at that point. So I don't know. I don't know how it would have morphed had September 11th not happened. I think a lot of the changes, you know, in controls were wielded in anticipation, you know, by Al-Qaeda.
I'm trying to.
It's a very difficult. Sorry, I don't mean to sort of go off. It's a very difficult.
No, that's fine. I want to thank the caller and try to get at least one more. We'll go to Muhammad, the next person here in line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to reading your guest book, and I admire her analysis of what's going on there and what's gone on there, and even more her nerve for being in that area. But what I was wondering is, to what extent, looking forward, how do you see, or what constituency is there for a change that the United States would be opting for, like stability and, you know, and such? Is it all based on Karzai and certain leaders, or is there any real constituency that you might see as being useful or instrumental in changing Afghanistan towards a better status?
Sure.
Now?
First, I love the region, so it doesn't take any nerve at all to live in the region. The people are fabulous in both countries. In Afghanistan, there's a whole nation of people. I think what has to be done, I mean, you know, the certain messages has to be sent out, and people have to be held accountable. And people who have committed atrocities, who are power brokers today, have to be held accountable. And so that the message is sent out that it's not business as usual in Afghanistan. And some really tough decisions have to be taken by Hamid Karzai. Tough decisions that should have been taken also with the U.S. administration when the international community was really actively involved in the first 2 years after the collapse of the Taliban, that would have given strength to decisions and to, you know, holding people accountable. It's very difficult now, but for sure, I mean, you know, Afghanistan is a nation of 20-some million. I mean, there's been no good census done, but, you know, and people who have a desire, a tremendous desire for their country, but, you know, to let it be held hostage by a handful of people, because those are the only names that the people, the U.S. administration or the people know, is really does a disservice to individuals. I think tough decisions have to be made, and accountability is really important, and institution building.
Do you feel that it's like an administration's lack of imagination or lack of moral clarity in this matter that's holding us back?
I think lack of commitment, really. You know, I mean, the you have only so resources are finite. You know, so you husband your resources because your interest really is elsewhere, and so you hand off a place to who the people that you've recruited or you've declared are the winners, and that's what happened, and they did to the country what they had done before between 92 and 96, and so it's really a lack of real commitment as such, and it does a real disservice to Afghans, because, you know, if it all collapses after, in, you know, real interest goes completely, then people will say, well, look at these Afghans. You know, we gave them the best chance ever, and you know, who can figure them out? It's, you know, hundreds of years of fighting among themselves. And it's not fair because, you know, you build a house of cards and it collapses on them, and then you blame them. So I think that, to me, is sort of the biggest concern, is that then the Afghans get sort of blamed and said, well, you know, they should have done this and could have done that. And, you know, well, whereas they really believe that they accepted these people coming back because they came back with the international community post-Taliban. And so they really believed that they wouldn't be allowed to return the country to the condition it was before. That takes commitment, not just from the U.S., from the international community. It's not all on a single nation's shoulder. I mean, the U.S., yes, is a single superpower, but it's an international community that made a commitment, supposedly.
What sort of power really does President Karzai have?
Well, he certainly has the power to make decisions if he wants to take those tough decisions. That being said, you can't change things overnight. He is isolated in many ways to the palace. He is surrounded by a lot of young people who have come from America who are getting paid huge salaries, Afghan Americans who are getting paid huge salaries, who have been brought in from outside, who sort of surround him and feed him a lot of happy news. And so that further isolates him. I saw him about 3 weeks ago, before I started on this book tour. I spent a couple of hours having tea with him at the palace, just sort of, you know, chatting with him about the situation, trying to get his take on things. Because, as I say, I've known him for a lot of years. While he has and has had always sort of this huge desire for his nation, he really hasn't taken the tough decisions that were required of him, and he hasn't really had the support for those tough decisions either. And today he's surrounded by a lot of people that get paid a lot of money, young people from the United States, Afghan Americans, who are, I think, maybe further isolating him in a lot of ways.
We will have to stop. My apologies. We have a caller we can't take. I'm sure at some future date we'll get back to the subject, but for the moment we'll have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Kathy Gannon, Associated Press correspondent, Pakistan-Afghanistan from 86 until this year, and she is sometime soon, I'm sure she hopes, going to be going to Iran and reporting from Iran for the AP. Her book is I is for Infidel, From Holy War to Holy Terror, 18 Years Inside Afghanistan, published by Public Affairs. Ms. Gannon, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. It was a pleasure.
The broadcast today made possible in part by a grant from Horeen's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horeen's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Focus 580 is also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. That's just about it for us here on Focus. Tomorrow morning, it's the first Wednesday of the month. Doyle Moore will be with us. We'll talk about food, as we do and have for some time. Then in the second hour tomorrow, we'll be talking about world music and particularly about how African popular music has circulated and become popular around the world, certainly outside of Africa. And our guest there will be Christopher Waterman. He is Dean of the University of California, Los Angeles School of the Arts and Architecture, and will be here on the campus to give a talk. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions. Right now, we hope that you will stay tuned. Up next, The Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll take a look at healthcare in our final years. Our guest will be Dr. Joanne Lynn. She says healthcare and community services fall short of the needs of people who face a prolonged period of progressive illness and disability before death. I welcome your telephone calls, your questions and comments for Joanne Lynn today following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade, and the figures that I'm going to share with you now are delayed just a couple of minutes. Here we go. December wheat trading at 347 and a quarter, down 1.5. March, 360 and a half, down 2. December corn, 205 and three quarters, down 3.